Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to another Rahalastapa Book Club, Rahalastapa Cup. This week's guest is, I don't know who she is, I've never heard of her. She's TV's Emma Kennedy, and she's written a book called Letters from Brenda, which I am disappointed to say is very good.
You're in. Hello, it. Em. You're in it. You actually feature in it.
I asked you to do this before I realised I was in it, so it is a bit. We'll definitely talk about me being in it. Mainly that's the main take home for me.
I hope you enjoyed the joke that I put in it about you, that only people who know our relationship inside and out will ever understand, and that everyone else reading it will just think I've just been rude about you.
Where you say Stuart is an amazing esoteric genius.
Yes.
And I like baked potatoes.
Yes.
Yes. I did enjoy that, Emma, yes. So, Emma, for those who may... I mean, I think people know who you are, probably, who people listen to my podcast. You are a writer now, mainly, but also have been acting, doing comedy. Obviously, did some podcasts with me and some TV shows with me. You were Nostradamus.
Of course,
memorably. But you've also written a lot. How many books have you written before this one? Let me just quickly talk about your previous book writing skills.
I think this is my 14th book.
What?
I know, which is sort of ridiculous. And it started way back in the day, I've sort of got you to thank for this. I know I have said this of many a time, but I have got, if there is one person I need to thank for the entirety of my career, it's pretty much you. It always boils down back to you. And I remember when you started writing a blog, and you were sort of like the only person who was writing a blog. You and the prostitute who no one knew what their name was, Belle de Jour. It was basically Belle de Jour and you, and there was no one else.
Yeah.
And I had just sort of started thinking, I'd really like to write a book. It had always been the one thing I'd always wanted to do, but had never done. And two things happened. You said to me, why don't you start writing a blog? And my literary agent also said, start writing a blog, because then you'll get into the hang of writing things every day. And also you'll quickly find out what it is you've got to say and what things you write well and what things you don't write well. So that's how it all began, sort of writing that blog. And then that blog turned into my first book, which is not really a book. It's more just an amalgam of the blog hastily put together. which was How to Bring Up Your Parents. My first proper book was The Tent, The Bucket and Me, which became a very surprise bestseller. I did not expect that book to do as well as it did, but it really did great guns. And and that was because another publisher had come to me and said, oh, can we turn your blog into a book? And I said, no, you can't, because it's already been done. So that's how that book came about. It was just it was like literally the offcut of an idea, because I had happened to be at my parents' house that Sunday having lunch with them. And we were just sitting around crying with laughter about how terrible our attempts to go on holiday was. And then that's how that book came about. So then I did that, and I did another couple of nonfiction books. And then I wrote some children's comedy crime thrillers, the Wilma Tenderfoot series. And then I moved back into adult fiction. And then I've sort of come full circle of my parental trilogy, as I like to call them. Yes. With this one, Letters from Brenda, and this is it now. This is the last time I will ever be writing about my family.
It's interesting that, because I think although this book is, I mean, I thought it'd be a serious book, which it certainly is in a lot of senses. There's still loads and loads of funny stuff, especially the letters of your parents on holiday. But there's lots of fun in this, but. Differently than The Tent, The Bucket and Me, which is just about how crazy and eccentric your family is, you sort of start in this book to look into why your mother in particular was so eccentric. And it's a proper psychological, psychiatric examination of someone who certainly had, you know, some mental problems.
Massively so.
So it's a kind of much more mature look at that subject. But whilst still acknowledging how funny families are, and we can all, I think, appreciate that.
It's a detective story, really.
Yeah.
Because when my mum died, apart from, you know, the day my mother died was really properly damaging. There were things that happened that day which I have still not been able to properly shake off. There's no doubt about that. And I think when you have that sort of level of trauma, It you're just left with all the bad bits. You're left about the things you feel ashamed about. You're left with the terrible last day and the last weeks that the person you loved had to endure. But you're also left with all the difficult bits about their life, and you forget when somebody has a long drawn out death. You forget the person that they used to be. And I sort of completely forgot about that until the owners of the new house found the letters up in the attic. And as you will see from the book, some of those letters are, you're just crying with laughter at them because they're so funny. And you just remember, it was that in and of itself was really important for me to remember what an incredible person my mother was. That she was, you know, vital, and she was incredibly charismatic, and she was sort of crazy in a good way, and she was really interesting, and you would never, ever, ever be bored in her company. But she also had this dark, unspoken about, undiagnosed mental illness that had been with her for all of her life and had affected my relationship with her in different ways at various stages of my life. But we had never, ever, ever addressed it during her lifetime. And so we never knew what was wrong with her. And so that was the big question, was our life was turned upside down by her constantly. And then our life was turned upside down again when she died, because we had all these unanswered questions. So when I found the letters, that was the starting point, the springboard for me finally trying to set out once and for all to discover what it was my mother had suffered with for all of her life and why.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about in the book how you couldn't really address it at the time, because she wouldn't have gone along with any of it, and you know, she was so dominant. I obviously met your mum, and I really have, as I think most people just really loved her.
Did you fancy her a bit?
I did. I'm slightly disappointed she didn't try and seduce me. Now I've read the book. What was wrong? I hate to tell you this,
Richard, but I'm afraid she fancied Stuart.
I've gone right off her.
I'm sorry. The truth hurts, but there it is.
Because I don't know. I love that sort of the disparity or whatever it is between that comedy and, I mean, it's just so fascinating. And then the sort of root causes of it, and as she's getting older, especially, which I think is very current as well, the sort of paranoia that kind of came into her life as she got into it. I've seen this, you see it a lot, and it explains a lot. People get into their 50s and their 60s and become much more paranoid, and she became paranoid about the FBI and her neighbours trying to do things to her. And it sort of seems to be the kind of, you know, an underlying thing amongst, you know, a decent proportion of our society.
I mean, I'd be interested to know whether this is something that men of this age go through as well. But it's certainly the minute she hit menopause, her health, which was, you know, precarious at the best of times, her mental health, just went off the rails, completely off the rails. And I think the worst incident I can remember was when she had just been diagnosed with having cancer, and I sat with her in an oncologist's office, and she told the consultant, without any sense of, oh, I'm joking, she said, oh yes, the CIA had given her cancer in a bookshop in Cambridge.
Yeah.
And here's the other thing that always sort of I still can't get my head around is that myself and my dad were with her, and not one of us batted an eyelid, because this was our normal.
Yeah.
It was like it's just Brenda being Brenda. But it's just like, it's not normal to tell people that you've been given cancer by a CIA operative in a fucking bookshop.
It's not, but I think it does. I think it hits a lot of people. And I think with your mum as well, because she was a very sexual being, or sex was very important to her, obviously, in her life. I think this happens more to men, actually. I think they kind of lose the power they've had all their life and the privilege they've had all their life, and they hit middle age and nobody's interested. The girls they're interested in, the women they're interested in, are certainly never going to be interested in them again. And I think that... I think that loss of power and that loss of sexual power drives a lot of people doolally, and so they're channeling all that stuff into a different area.
It's about self-identity, isn't it? If your identity is wrapped up in your attractiveness and the fact that you have a certain degree of power over the opposite sex or the same sex, depending on your predilections,
of course.
But if that is gone, then it's sort of like soup when Superman loses his powers and has to go and eat hamburgers and just wanders around looking miserable. It's that, isn't it? You lose a sense of who you think you are.
And, you know, I think also the things that would have seemed, you know, it's interesting, I think knowing the other books as well, the things that would have seemed eccentric or just funny or, you know, or... I mean, even, you know, I'd always say, poor Tony, your poor dad, Tony. I always feel so sorry for him in all the books, but especially in this one, the stuff he has to put up with.
He's an absolute saint.
It seems funny, a domineering wife and a lovely husband. It seems funny. But then, of course, you know, now you, in this book, the things he had to put up with and the things that he forgave, obviously, a mum was...
The one that always gets me is the second affair she had, and my father, who is you've met him many times, but he is a very mild mannered Welshman, is he not?
He is
very mild mannered man. You know, he would stitch my name into all my PE kit when I was little. You know, this was the guy who fed me every meal I'd ever had. And I remember he turned up at my door and he was very teary, and I sat him down on the edge of my bed, and he just sort of sat there and told me that he'd just walked in on my mother, who was on her knees, giving a younger man a blowjob, and she turned round and saw him, and the only words that came out of my mouth, I mean, you might think like a normal person would go, oh God, you know, I've been caught in the act, and like panic would set in. Her only words to him was, what are you doing creeping around the house? Like, he was in the wrong. And then her excuse for what she was doing was to say that she was trying to compare the differences between male and female pelvises. I mean, this is just a woman who just thinks she can get away with absolute murder. And that's how she was. But I think she was certainly assisted by the fact that my father was completely devoted to her. And I think if she'd been really boring, he probably would have been long gone. It will never fail to astonish me, the fact that he forgave two affairs and stuck with her till the very end and really properly looked after her when, you know, for the best part of 10 years when she had cancer. I mean, it's just incredible. He deserves
it. It is incredible, but, you know, this is the way love is, though, and relationships are different. And if he'd stood up to her, I think she would have probably left him, wouldn't she? So it's, you know, it worked because of who they both were.
She would have starved to death if she'd left him. I mean, this is the other thing we always have to remember. She couldn't drive. She didn't carry money. She didn't know how to use the washing machine. She'd never cooked a meal in her life. I mean, I've told this story many times about the one time that my father had to go to hospital for a week. And she had to look after me. And I turned to her and said, oh, you know, this is your big chance with me. And she gave me a pot of cockles that we couldn't get the lid off. That was her idea of giving me an evening meal. And then she'd make me phone up my friends and say, can we come to your house for dinner? And that's what we did for a week, was we'd go to a different friend every night with her just cackling, thinking that she was a genius.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's very, I mean, but again, that personality type is interesting now that personality type is sort of semi-ruling the world. Somebody who, I'm not saying your mum is as bad as Boris Johnson or Donald Trump, but there's...
Well, she's there's not far. There's, if my mother with power, can you imagine?
Yeah, exactly.
It's terrifying.
So it casts a different light on it. Even when you're reading all these, you know, all this letters about their kind of disastrous holidays they had together and everything going wrong, but obviously, like, a lot of it was just to do with them. She's always blaming anyone else but herself for anything that went little incident that went wrong. But it's clearly down to their own incompetence and madness and their own relationship. So it's completely
and utterly incompetent. Yes. Yeah. I just loved the running refrain throughout the letters where they're stuck in car parks because they haven't worked out still after about 20 plus years of trying to do this that the card goes in the other way round. I mean, fucking idiot.
It's great. So it is very funny, but obviously it is, and it starts, you know, it starts in a dark place, and we get to a dark place. And there's funniness in between. It's taken you, it's sort of seven or so years. It's 7 or 8 years since your mum died.
It's this week she died.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So did you need that time? I think you say in the book that you couldn't have written any earlier. You needed the distance to, because it's difficult to write. You know, I've written about my family and they're all still alive at the moment, luckily, thankfully. It's, you know, it's still difficult to write about personal stuff, but then when someone's died and when you're really going into it like you are in this book, I mean, it's a very honest and open book, and obviously you're writing about someone who's no longer with us. Did that make it more difficult even so, or was it the catharsis of getting through it for yourself?
I think it was a bit of both. It was definitely cathartic, 100%. But I wanted to be fair to her because I knew that there were going to be things that were going to be really critical and there were, and I was going to be writing about things that, that she would literally have come round to my house with a gun and killed me if I'd ever written about in her lifetime. But sure. I was really careful to involve my dad in every single part of it, and also her sister, Phyllis, mm-hmm. Because and actually there wasn't any point during it where the three of us sort of said, actually, no, don't put that in. So we have been quite open about it. But yeah. But Phyllis in particular, because obviously I interviewed them constantly for the whole thing. And at the end of it, she said this was like doing therapy. And it was. I think it was like therapy for the three of us. But again, I keep coming back to it because we hadn't known what was wrong with her. That in and of itself was a huge and massive burden. And I didn't think really when I started off writing it, because obviously I'm not a clinical psychologist and I'm not qualified to do so, that I didn't know if I would sort of get a definitive diagnosis or anywhere near to it. And sort of the conclusion of the book, I'd sort of really sort of reached a semi understanding that she'd been misunderstood during her life and this and that. But it was only when we sent the book off to a clinical psychiatrist and to just do a check read on it, really, just to make sure that I wasn't saying anything that was irresponsible. It was mm-hmm. mostly for that, and or I wasn't just plain making stuff up. And then he wrote me this incredible letter, which I hadn't been expecting. And he makes as close to a definitive diagnosis of her as we're probably ever going to get. And so then I asked him if I could include the letter as the epilogue. And he very kindly said yes. So we do, at the end, get a diagnosis. And that was like, yeah. Oh, my God, for me and Dad and Phyllis.
Yeah. I think, well, you know, as a stand-up, when it's, you know, obviously covering personal issues in comedy and through shows, I think it's an incredible thing to be able to do, and being able to write a book about stuff. I think just to get stuff down, we found this with a few of the books in the book club. You know, Georgia Pritchett's one really jumps to mind.
Yeah, so I love that book.
Yeah, but just by going through the process of writing it, it's a very difficult thing to do. But yeah, I mean, in a way, you know, if people are dead, it does relieve you of the burden of their own reaction to it, which I think. You're absolutely right. You couldn't have done this when she was alive, obviously.
I keep living in slight terror that she's going to reappear and absolutely tear me off a strip. It's like the child in me is absolutely terrified that the ghost of Brenda will come back and haunt me forever because I've written this book. But then the adult in me absolutely knows that she would have been standing next to it in Waterstones waiting for someone to recognise her.
Yes. Well, you know, I think, you know, she still comes out of it really well. I mean, genuinely, I loved her anyway, but I love her in this book. And she was forgiven by the people that mattered for what she did, but also there's something about her that is so powerfully likable.
That's a wild horse. She was a wild horse. And if you're standing in the middle of a field and a horse comes from nowhere and it doesn't belong to anyone and it comes over to you, you think, my God, this is the most magic thing that's ever happened in my life. And crumbs, it wants to spend time with me. What? It feels amazing. That would be something you would never forget for the rest of your life. But then, of course, a wild horse can turn and can crush your brains in. And that's sort of what it was like being around Brenda.
Yeah, and it was much harder for you, for the immediate family, because she was so charming. And, you know, and yeah, absolutely, having a book with herself on the front cover and looking beautiful. She's not going to be upset about it. You claim in the book that you've had contact with her via a medium and via
oh my god, via a that bird. Was so weird. That was so weird. So yeah, I'll tell the story. So my aunt Phyllis came to see me, and she said I went to see this medium, and Brenda came through, and I don't believe in any of this stuff. And I just thought, with my sort of storytelling hat on, I thought, well, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go and see the same medium, but I'm going to go under a different name. And obviously I'll be wearing a mask. So there's absolutely no chance whatsoever that this person is going to know who I am. And I went, and Brenda was the first person that came through. And again, you was thinking, of course she's going to say, oh, your mum's come through. And of course she's going to say, because that's what they always start off with, isn't it? And then if you go, oh, my mum's alive, they'll suddenly go, oh, no, sorry, it's your dad. And then, you know, blah, blah, blah. This is how we've all seen Derren Brown. We know how this works. But she started with a thing that literally sort of made me sort of the chills went right through me, because leading up to this writing this book, I was in the process of getting my Irish passport, because my grandmother was Irish, obviously, and Brexit, blah, blah, blah. And the search to get my passport was severely hampered because my great-grandmother had put my great-grandfather's name the wrong way round on my grandmother's birth certificate, and this caused all manner of trouble. Like, I had to get affidavits sworn. It was a really complicated process, and added about 500 quid onto the process, added about another year onto the process. It was an absolute nightmare. Anyway, first thing that this medium says was, oh, the names are wrong on the birth certificate. And I hadn't told anybody. Literally nobody knew about this. So it's like, if that's the first thing out of her mouth, you go, oh, shit. And then Brenda spent a good half an hour complaining about my then dad's new girlfriend in quite specific detail. This I did not put in the book because they were still going out when I wrote it. But if I just say that there was one very specific thing my mother wanted me to warn my dad about, and that did come true.
Right. Wow. Okay.
I won't say what, but it was okay. It was quite. So anyway, yes, I'm quite tempted to go back to the medium to see what Brenda's got to say now the book's out. I might do that and report back.
There might be another book in it. There might be a follow-up or an extra chapter for the paperback. Anyway, that would be that would be good.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's really excellent. I think people will enjoy it. It's also a quite a nice autobiography of you as well, and your own journey to becoming an author, and the twists and turns you've taken on the route to get there, which, as you say, does involve very heavily involves me.
It does.
And that it's, I think this, that's the story. Maybe we talked about this on the podcast before, but it doesn't matter if we did. But it is kind of weird that how connected our lives have been.
I mean, but really, also, we should be married. Much,
we should. Well, we thought about it, didn't we?
We did have a pact. Didn't we? That if we got to 40 and we weren't married yet, we were going to get married. But obviously,
that's the only reason I got married, was to make sure I didn't have to.
It is really weird. And I can honestly say that the things I have enjoyed most in my life, every single one of them has been because of you.
I really mean that. All the stuff
I ever did, sort of when I was doing acting and stuff, the only things I really ever properly enjoyed was when I did stuff with you. Nobody makes me laugh the way you make me laugh. No one.
Well, we are very similar. You know, and I think there is something going there. But it's sort of weird that we both think, don't we? I mean, are we sure that we kind of, because we both went for our Oxford interviews around about the same time. And we're pretty sure we met each other.
You were the first person I clapped eyes on. I remember it very distinctly. It was you. You were standing in the lodge.
Porter's Lodge,
At St. Catherine's, as I walked in, and you were standing there looking sick.
It's weird. We were both, at that time, you were applying to do history. Yeah. And I was taking the, you know, there's so many things that would have thrown this off as well. But we both got the same offer as well. We would have, you'd actually have been in the year above me had you not got glandular fever and then messed, you know, your exam suffered as a result. So we met each other then. And then when we did go to university, you ended up, I'd had a year off, so we were in the same year. And you were at Teddy Hall, and your tutorial partner was Stuart Lee. Yeah. It's like, and then we all started working together.
Yeah.
So it sort of feels like we would have.
It was destiny. Yeah.
But absolutely, all those things that push that, you know, and you getting ill to make that happen, and you know, it's really interesting anyway about, even if you're not me and I'm involved in it, about, you know, the decisions you made and the way that, you know, it feels, though obviously this is the benefit of hindsight, that you were sort of pushed. Because you decided not to go to university, you were happy working where you were working once you failed to get into university, and your sort of chance meeting with your English teacher put you back on track to go to university. But you know, and then you made loads of stupid choices in your career anyway. But it's all part of, isn't it? It's all leading up to, so to try becoming a solicitor, and whilst everyone else came to London and tried to make it in show business to be sensible.
Didn't even occur to me that was something I was even allowed to do. That's what's so weird about it. And I wonder if that's because, like, nobody in my family had ever had a creative career, but then no one in your family had had a creative career.
I think the one thing
I've always lacked is it's not ambition, because I like to do well. I like to work hard and do well, but I never had a forward plan, which I think a lot of my contemporaries did have a forward plan. They sort of like they knew where they were going, whereas I don't think I ever did know where I was going. I feel like I have slightly bumbled through life. Just sort of going, oh, yes, that'll be good. Oh, that'll be fun. Yeah, that'll be fun. Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, I'll enjoy that. I suppose there was a point when I gave up being a lawyer, I definitely said to myself, you are not going to do a single other day of your life in which you don't enjoy doing it, and you're not going to take any job you know you're not going to enjoy. And I've sort of stuck to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's often when you do something wrong and you knew it was wrong straight away, but you still had to see it all through. Yeah, but you know, it is. But you know, luckily, when you're young, you can spend 3 or 4 years doing something, and it sort of doesn't matter, weirdly. Mm. But you know, you go through something, and then it does push you on to the next thing. But you know, the book reads like, you know, you you end up, you know, tutorial partner with Stuart Lee, which is a stroke of luck. You end up bumping into Sue Perkins when you're lost in Edinburgh, and that, yes, the end up. So, you know, yes, obviously there's lots of people, there's lots of things that, you know, other paths that we don't hear about, or the other paths that could have been taken. But those bits of luck, it just feels like, it really feels like you're being pushed.
It is weird.
Nudged in a direction.
It's like that. I love that, those things where you have random encounters with people who are going to be really significant to you in your life. And this has happened with every single significant friendship or relationship that I've ever had. Like my best friend at university was this brilliant woman called Bernadette, who you will know who you will be aware of.
I am very aware of her.
And it turned out that I had met her before at a Simple Minds concert in Milton Keynes, where I'd been trying to get to the front, and this was before I'd even gone to university. I was still at school. And there was this small group of very posh girls sitting in a circle. And I stopped and chatted to this one girl for quite a while. And that was Bernadette. How mad. So there was that. Then there's you. The whole, you know, Richard Herring is clearly supposed to be somebody in my life. Then there was Sue Perkins. And then I went to see Alison Moyet doing a little gig at Ronnie Scott's. And this woman came up at the end and said, "Hello, Alison, would like to see you backstage." Anyway, that person turned out to be the person I married.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, it is, that's how, in hindsight, everything sort of works like that. But it does seem with you, it feels this, and even, you know, even going through, I'd forgotten how much work you'd got so quickly, you know, you listing, yeah, all these TV shows by the late 90s.
Yeah,
you were sort of doing so many jobs.
Yeah, late 90s through to about 2007, really. I was just non-stop working, non-stop. Yeah. And then I packed it all in, really, in order to write books instead.
Yeah.
And now, I wouldn't say no to doing acting, because in certain circumstances, I really, really enjoy it. But I would only now do it if it was for someone I really like. I mean, I'd do anything for you, obviously. That goes without saying. You're the only person that I would probably say yes to, even if you were asking me to dangle naked from a string. Please don't ask me to dangle naked from a string. But it's like, you know, probably you and Perks are probably the only two people who, like, I've just been doing a job with Sue. Yeah. But you two are the only people who I would automatically say yes to without even thinking.
It's nice that you see yourself as a writer now, you know, and it's nice that even that the journey from all of that TV, you know, work and success to realizing that what you really, really wanted to do was to write. And it's, you know, and it took a little while to get there, didn't it? You were doing bits and bobs,
I didn't really do any writing at all at university, certainly when we were doing stuff.
No.
I'm not a sketch writer. I think that's the thing. I think sketch writing is a real craft, and that's not my thing. I can write dialogue, and I can write scripts, but sketches is not where I'm at. That's not what I'm good at.
No, and it's in the long term, that's not a very useful skill anyway, because it's a good starting place to, you know, to get going and in writing scripts, I think. But yeah, I think as you get older, you kind of want to do something with a bit more.
And I'm not a stand-up. I'm not a stand-up. I never have been. I can do comedy acting, especially if it's women pretending to be Welsh men. or any character that wears ridiculous hats. I can do those till the cows come home. But it always baffles me when I'm introduced as a comedian, which I'm not. I've never was. I did some.
Yeah,
I did,
but you're funny. You can't just say you're funny. You're funny.
Yeah, I'm just funny.
You're very funny. But yeah, so you get a lot of you in there. You get a lot, you know. I think it's a very mature book, and it's a very enjoyable book. I listened to the audiobook, which is also very impressive for who you have playing your mother and your father, I think.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Juliet Stevenson.
Juliet Blinken Stevenson. And what was even more exciting was that Juliet Stevenson kept texting me while she was doing it in order to ask for advice on various bits and bobs. But my goodness me, can you imagine what Brenda would have thought if she knew that Juliet Stevenson was going to be being her in an audio, which is quite funny because she did know that Catherine Parkinson was going to be her in the Kennedy.
Right,
yeah, and she just pulled her face. She didn't really know who she was. I don't think she sort of thought, oh, no, it's Judi Dench, surely. Or an Oscar winner. But Juliet Stevenson, she loved Juliet Stevenson. She definitely knew who Juliet Stevenson was.
And she's brilliant. No, she gets it all. I mean, I suppose you'd expect a fantastic actor like her to do so, but she completely gets it right. And the attitude is bang on.
Yeah, it's good. The audiobook. I'm really pleased with how it's turned out because normally with audiobooks you have to read it all yourself, but I think it was really important that we had someone else doing the letters.
It's an absolutely correct decision. I think like some people might not have thought of that. And some of the, oh, I'll do that. You know, that's fine. But yeah, absolutely. I think an audiobook that makes an effort. I mean, Adam Buxton is a very hard one to beat, I think, in terms of just making an effort to make it presented as more of an experience than just a read of the book. But this really does have that as well. And I wasn't sure to begin with.
Go on. No, you go.
I was going to say, I wasn't sure to begin with about, because you, when you're doing your footnotes, you kind of come in as if you're speaking in the box. And to begin with, I thought, I'm not sure about that. But then I actually really liked it. So you press a button and go, I just want to say that this is... Yes. And it actually really it really works as a piece of theatre. Yes. For a second, I went, oh, it took me out of it for a second. But then once I got into it, I really liked that. So it's very well produced.
I think that was one of the main reasons why it was important to have a different voice to do the letters, was because of the footnotes. Because we had a really long chat about it, and there was a point where we were thinking, well, do we put the footnotes into the audiobook or not? And then we decided,
you need them.
You definitely need them. So that's how we did that.
It's perfect. It's perfect. So it feels like having badinage with them. But so I did very much. I try to do audiobooks now if I can, just so I can, you know, I find I can get through. I have to get through a lot of books now because I'm doing this, but I can get through books really quickly with the audiobooks because
say, honestly, you are the hardest working person I have ever known in my life. What have you got now? You've got your Leicester Square podcast. You're doing the nervous breakdown on screen of Leon. What is it?
Twitch
of fun.
Well, they're all.
I'm obsessed with, by the way. I'm absolutely obsessed with Twitch of fun. I think it is absolute genius. You've got this now. You've got the snooker. You've got the stone gathering. Is there anything else I've missed out here?
Well, I've written a book.
Yeah, you've written books.
I've written a sitcom coming up. I do work, you know, but like you have realised, and like the book makes clear, if you're doing something that you enjoy doing. Writing a book is the hardest thing, I think, though I quite enjoyed the last one I did. But, you know, this is all fun. And this is easy. And like doing this, which is listening to a book and then talking to an author, is sort of, you know, and usually it's an honour. And this week it's not as good. Usually it's exciting to talk to an author about a book you like. So it's, you know, this is a fun thing to do. I'm sort of on holiday at the moment, really, though I'm still producing.
Is your house still haunted, by the way?
No, not as much. My kids feel like they're slightly psychic. I tell this story in next week's book club podcast, but I'll tell you it again because we're recording next week's already. The other day, my my son was, we went to Pizza Express, and my son's usually very friendly with people, like strangers, and says, oh, hello, and, you know, wants to, and joins in and tries to get in the conversations. We were having our pizza, and then this couple came in, and the woman was heavily pregnant, and she was with a man, and they just sat down right next to us. And my son just turned and said, why aren't you married? And my wife... Like, he's never behaved like that before. My wife noticed the woman didn't have a wedding ring or anything, which my son definitely would not have noticed. And it felt like he'd been possessed by, you know, the spirit of some furious Victorian clergyman.
I wonder if he had been possessed by the spirit of the fetus, who is furious that they're going to be born a bastard.
Maybe. I mean, it's possible that they...
It could be like that show that you're obsessed with when they jump into someone else's body. What is
quantum
it?
Quantum leap.
Yes, quantum leap. Maybe the fetus quantum leapt into Ernie.
Yeah. Well, he sees ghosts. You know, he talks about people being in his. There's a door in his room that used to lead into our bedroom that's blocked up, but he's obsessed with that door and the possibility of people coming through it and stuff. So
that means there are ghosts. Have you had Lou Conran round yet to your actual house to sort of walk about?
She hasn't come over, but she's seen the house via this camera. And I told her some of those stories for rehearsed, but yeah. So, yeah. Well, look, this show is not about me, unlike this fantastic book, Letters from Brenda. If you want to find out more about me, there isn't much about me in there, but it's worth it for completists. Have you got your next book on the way?
I've just finished writing the prologue to it, and I'm sort of about halfway through the first chapter of what I hope will be my next book. I don't know about you when you're starting, but I have got lots of first chapters that will then go nowhere else. But I think you have to write a first chapter in order to work out whether it they are characters that you want to be around for 3 to 6 months. And whether or not it's got legs. But I'm quite I think this one might go. So I'm doing that. And
do you write them on spec, or do you have as your publisher saying, we'll take your next book, whatever it is, Emma?
We'll have a conversation about a book, but I don't know about you. You might be luckier than me, but every publisher I've ever had always wants to see 5,000 words before they commit.
Right.
Every single time.
I've never had to do that.
Oh, you bastard.
I don't think I could do it. I've never written a novel, though, but I could. I don't think I could write a novel unless I knew it was going to be published, because it's too much. Mm. I've tried it, and I think it's too much.
Yes, now I'm thinking about this. I've never had to do this with a non-fiction book, so maybe it is just fiction books.
Right.
Where the publisher always requires it. But... With fiction, I don't know whether this is true of nonfiction or not, but I know with fiction, it's not just the editor that you're talking to who makes the decision. It's like a whole panel of people. So hence they need some material. Yeah. I never get an easy ride.
But you keep, you know, I having don't written think four, I, 14 I, books. Is
yeah, I know.
Thing,
it's crazy. It's crazy. It's still like, it's the first one, always.
And it's weird having you, you know, especially with you having I've never been on anything like a bestsellers list. I've never got, you know, my books have never, I don't know what they sell okay enough to do another one, but not enough to make any kind of impact. So for you to have had those books that have been that successful, and for it still to be difficult, I mean, it is a difficult thing. And, you know, it is a privilege to write a book, and it's a privilege to get a book published, obviously, but you would think after 20 years.
I know, but the thing is that I'm in that difficult zone. People who do really, really well are either debut authors, or there's that top tier of writers who everyone buys all their books, and they could literally do a shit on a page and it would sell a million copies. You know, so there's that. And then in between, there's all the mid-ranking authors, and that's what I am. I'm a mid-ranking author. And some of my books will do all right, and some will underperform, and some will do very well. But there's no sort of gold standard guarantee on anything that goes out. And also the other thing that I mean, if anyone's listening to this and they want to be an author, the average author only sells 1,000 copies. I remember there was one book one year that won the Booker, and it had only sold 900 copies. So, you know, so there's that element of it. And you could write a brilliant book and it might do nothing. And then you'll see a book that is rubbish and it goes absolutely ballistic. There is no rhyme nor reason to which books sell off the shelves, really. It's a combination of cover, marketing, and whether the right reviewers have reviewed it. That's what it boils down to.
Well, it's a very, very difficult thing, you know, because again, especially now, there's so much, so many books come out.
So many.
So like, it's the same as when we did TV in the 1990s. There weren't that many comedy shows coming out. So if something happened, it was a bit of a big deal. Mm. But it used to be the case with books as well, I'm sure. But now it's, you know, my book's coming out in October and there'll be, what, 500 books? I don't know. Yeah. I don't even know how many books it is, but it's an insanely competitive thing. Do you read a lot of other people's stuff? Are you reading anything at the moment that you would like to recommend?
Oh, now then. Yes. What was the last thing I read and I thought it was really good? I wonder if I've got it here. I'm currently reading One Day I May Astonish the World, which is Nina Stibb's new book. I really like Nina Stibb and think she's fantastic. But the book before that I thought was exceptional was the Katie Wicks memoir. Have you read it?
Oh, yes, yeah. I haven't read it yet. No, everyone's been saying it. I think my wife's read it.
It's great. It's really great. I loved it and I thoroughly recommend it. And George's book. Well, I loved that as well.
Yeah, it's really good fun, George's book, but as well as being heartbreakingly sad.
I've been rereading Graham Greene because I loved him when I was a child. I'd forgotten what a brilliant, brilliant writer he is. And if you haven't read any Graham Greene, read The End of the Affair, which I think is one of the most perfectly written books I've ever read.
I haven't read any Graham Greene for a long time. Yeah, I used to read him. It stands up then. It still stands up even
it's
in
incredible. It's
incredible.
I tell you what hasn't stood up. me and the wife, we watched Top Gun last night in preparation for Top Gun Maverick and thinking, you know, fond memories of it as being this sensational film. It's a pile of absolute dog shit.
I've never actually seen Top Gun.
Rubbish.
Well, the new ones, everyone's very excited about the new one.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that works out. Look, it's really great to always great to talk to you. I haven't seen you as much as we usual for a little while. So,
and I love you so much. I love you so much, Harry.
But everyone should buy Letters from Brenda. It is Emma's best book so far.
It is.
Bear in mind, all her other books have been shit. And they've all been good. And this is even... It's fun. I haven't done that with any of the other authors. Catherine Rundell, bear in mind, her other books have been shit. And one of that done's pretty good. It's a fabulous book. But listen to the audiobook. I always say listen to the audiobook, but it's a really good audiobook as well. And the letter writing format of it really suits that as well. Thank you very much, Emma, for being on the show. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, for producing it.
Yeah, thanks, Chris Evans.
See you again. Bye.
Bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to gofasterstripe.com for fantastic downloads and books and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, richardherring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It will make me feel sad.